It is time for the Media Beat from David Tereshchuk, his weekly review of media coverage for Robinhood Radio and exclusive to Robinhood Radio. David is a multimedia and international journalist with his own online column at themediabeat.us. And as a special correspondent since 2012, he has contributed TV reports to the PBS network, mostly on ethical issues. Here's David.
This is David Tereshchuk with the Media Beat for the weekend beginning June 14th, 2024. It's the little things that count, people say. What counts as little will naturally vary a lot between us all. There was a time when, for the major TV network news divisions, it mattered enormously where in the world the anchor of its evening news broadcast was situated for the show. It seemed important to network producers, but I always found it was of much lesser interest among the general public, that question of where the headlines were being read out from. But that's how it went. A sudden upsurge in the Balkans War, and Peter Jennings was dispatched to anchor ABC's World News Tonight from Sarajevo. Sometime later, for East Asia's devastating historic tsunami, Peter's opposite numbers, then Brian Williams of NBC and still Dan Rather of CBS, both got to look well-kempt but still windswept on the battered shores of Indonesia and other Indian Ocean and Pacific countries. This week, the familiar pattern on public radio of having anchors bounce their intros and outros between each other on America's east and west coasts suddenly got globalized. On NPR's Morning Edition, we had Michel Martin in Washington, D.C., and Rob Schmitz anchoring as well as reporting as network international correspondent from Berlin, Germany. Another D.C. anchor on another day, Steve Inskeep, described the new dimension as being bi-hemispheric instead of the usual mere bi-coastal broadcasting. If you think that the temporary change might have had something to do with big news coming out of Europe, then I think you might be right. Big news, yes. Good news? Decidedly not. Not for those who fear, for democratic institutions and perhaps for democracy itself. Voters all across Europe, that is in the 27 countries making up the European Union, cast their votes for the European Parliament over several days, and the results have been troubling. For me, it's one of those occasions when I wish I had been wrong. You might remember 6 weeks ago when the Media Beat came from the most westerly part of the EU, Ireland, I was highlighting some pretty dire predictions that the hard far right, in some cases outright neo-Nazi parties, were posed for a surge of success in those elections. I quoted from continental Europe some journalistically snappy summaries of the right-wingers' most unifying position, that of being anti-immigrant. The label that resonates most for me came from a German colleague saying the rightists are, I quote, anti-immigration, anti-Semitic, and Islamophobic, deep in the fantasy of a homogeneous society without aliens. And the same reporting source, you might recall, also said, quote, we should be very afraid. Such extremists could achieve a massive impact during the Euro vote. Well, the Euro results are now in, and however much they were foreseen, they have definitely spooked much of Europe. Possibly more than anywhere else, they have spooked France. The extreme right party, the National Rally under Marine Le Pen, daughter of the longtime Nazi sympathizer, the late Jean-Marie Le Pen, scored a remarkable one-third of the French electorate. Perhaps even more significantly, the French president's own party, En Marche, managed to garner only half that much support, around 15%. The president himself, Emmanuel Macron, seemed to take it very hard. Well, certainly, he had a very dramatic reaction. Within hours, he announced national elections to choose a new set of members for France's own parliament, to be held at the end of this month and the first week of July. The French media commentariat has seemed at a loss on what to conclude about this. Is it bold of Macron, or just totally reckless? Maybe to use actual French words, fou or folle. words which give us the English term folly. In French, though, they carry a greater suggestion than simple foolishness. It's more like crazy, insane. The modern-day French Republic has, of course, its separation of powers, and Macron could end up with the far right in charge of the legislature while he would remain as president, though a very isolated one. That kind of divided government has a French term of jargon all its own, cohabitation, cohabitation. But never before has the distinction between the two sides of such a division been quite so extreme. The presidential palace press office had to quash rumours this week, rumours fanned into flame by Le Pen supporters, of course, that Macron would resign if he lost this high-stakes standoff. Macron also spoke in person, giving an interview to Le Figaro newspaper. He said, "It is not the national rally that writes the constitution, nor the spirit of it. The institutions are clear, and so is the place of the president, whatever the result." This time next month, we should know how that result has turned out, not just in the parliament, but in Macron's response to what kind of parliament it may have become by then. On our American side of the Atlantic and in our elections, it's of course legal cases, especially criminal ones, that are getting thoroughly entwined, as just about everybody saw they would get, with the presidential contest. As part of a Manhattan court's preparation for, a month from now, the sentencing of Donald Trump following his guilty verdict on all 34 counts in the hush money felony case, Trump met earlier this week with his probation officer via video conference. A small news item, but there's something very redolent about that mundane court reporter's turn of phrase. Donald Trump met with his probation officer. Meanwhile, in the same week, a court has found Joe Biden's son Hunter guilty on 3 gun-related charges, and we await his other trial on tax-related charges, all of which were incurred, we're told, when he was under the influence of illicit drugs. Then Trump, yes, him again, has this week been relieved of one allegation in his mishandling of classified documents case in Florida. But he's still facing the main bulk of charges laid against him there. This is to say nothing, for now, about the two other criminal cases against him for 2020 election interference. One federal and one in Georgia, which may, or more likely now, will not gain some degree of public hearing before Election Day. And I'm leaving out the 9 felony charges alleging an attempted overturn of 2020's election result in Arizona. Charges against Trump lawyers Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman, as well as his one-time chief of staff, Mark Meadows. Trump himself is merely, I say, an unindicted co-conspirator in that case. Just a footnote here, one that not many news outlets reported, but The Hill, that dedicated politics watcher in print around D.C. and online everywhere, took some glee in telling us that apparently, and I quote, "Arizona officials struggled to track Giuliani for weeks after the charges were filed to serve him with a summons." Many slews of partisan reporting on these various criminal cases are inevitably rife with false equivalences and stretched comparisons, as well as all the usual loathsome efforts at character assassination. In other words, all par for the course these days in coverage of American politics. My final footnote, perhaps more substantial than a footnote, also concerns politics and the law, and in this case, again, extremist politics. The news was best put together by my local New York commercial TV station, WABC, actually by their assiduous news reporter, Anthony Carlo. He provided full background to charges laid against an alleged firearms dealer, aged 24, who had been incarcerated already in a federal prison, but who was, the charges allege, able to run a peddling operation to sell guns and gun parts from his cell. His mistake came, apparently, when he offered weaponry to a possible buyer online who turned out to be a New York undercover cop. More troubling, we might think, was the fact that the ostensible purposes of the gun-dealing venue online, a channel of the Telegram app, was the constitutionally protected, supposedly free speech promotion of vicious, racially motivated extremism, complete with the prominent display of a swastika symbol. Among the highest web traffic for this same channel had come 2 years ago, with the horrific supermarket shooting in Buffalo, New York, when 10 African-American customers and workers were killed by a young white supremacist who had been a frequent digital visitor to the chat and sales site. Our city's Deputy Police Commissioner for Intelligence and Counterterrorism, Rebecca Weiner, said the case was, I quote, "an example of how, in today's world, even straightforward crime," she meant like illicit gun dealing, of course, "often has a very multidimensional backdrop, as was the case in this investigation." My borough district attorney, Manhattan's Alvin Bragg, was a little less generalizing and a tad more specific than the police chief. He has been basking, more or less discreetly, in his recent victory, that guilty verdict in the Trump hush payments case, and he was quoted by WABC describing this latest and less nationally reported weapons arrest as, quote, "the intersection of gun violence and gun trafficking with hate and extremism. It is very, very disturbing." That's all from the Media Beat for this week. If you have been, thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, David. We will talk to you next week. David can be found at themediabeat.us.